added a retainer, then a delivery fee. They raised prices at the start of the teaching period when demand was high, only to offer bargains at the end of the term when there was no longer a need for a specimen. Morbid paradoxes confronted Stevens daily. His profession worked to extend life while secretly hoping for an increase in the deceased. A malpractice suit called you before the judge for want of a skill, but get caught with an ill-gotten cadaver, and the judge punished you for trying to obtain that skill. Proctor made its students pay for their own pathological specimens. Stevens' first anatomy course required 2 complete dissections. How was he supposed to pay for that? Back home in Maine, he'd been spoiled by his mother's cooking. The women on her side were gifted. Here in the city, tuition, books, lectures, and rent had him subsisting on crusts for days on end. When Carpenter invited Stevens to work for him, he did not hesitate. His appearance scared Stevens. That first delivery months before, the grave robber was an Irish giant, imposing in frame, uncouth in manner and speech, and carried with him the reek of damp earth. Carpenter and his wife had 6 children. When 2 of them passed from yellow fever, he sold them for anatomical study, or so it was said. Stevens was too scared to ask for refutation. When trafficking in cadavers, it helped to be immune to sentimentality. He wouldn't be the first body snatcher to open a grave to find the face of a long-lost cousin or a dear friend. Carpenter recruited his gang at the saloon, rowdies all. They slept the day, drank well into the evening, and then set off for their pastime. The hours are not great, but suit a certain character. Criminal character. Incorrigible by any measure. It was a low enterprise. Raiding cemeteries was the least of it. The competition was a pack of rabid animals. Leave a prospect to too late in the evening, and you were liable to discover someone else had pilfered the body first. Carpenter reported his competition's clients to the police, broke into dissection rooms to mutilate their deliveries. Brawls erupted when rival gangs converged on the same pauper's field. They smashed one another's faces among the tombstones. "It was raucous," Carpenter always said when he finished one of his stories, grinning through his mossy teeth. In his glory days, Carpenter elevated the ploys and chicanery of his trade to a devilish art. He brought rocks in wheelbarrows for undertakers to bury and carried away the deceased. An actor taught his nieces and nephews to cry on demand, the craft of bereavement. Then they made the rounds of the morgue, claiming bodies as long-lost relatives. Although Carpenter was not above simply stealing bodies from the coroner when he had to. On more than one occasion, Carpenter sold a cadaver to an anatomical school, reported the body to the police, and then had his wife, dressed in mourning clothes, claim it as her son. Whereupon Carpenter sold the body again to another school. It saved the county the expense of burial. No one looked too closely. Eventually, the body trade grew so reckless that relatives took to holding graveside vigils, lest their loved ones disappear in the night. Suddenly, every missing child was perceived to have been a victim of foul play, snatched, dispatched, and then sold for dissection. The newspapers took up the cause in outraged editorials. The law stepped in. In this new climate, most body snatchers extended their territory, riffling the graves of distant cemeteries to space out their raids. Carpenter turned to niggers exclusively. The niggers did not post sentries over their dead. Niggers did not pound on the door of the sheriff. They did not haunt the offices of the newspapermen. No sheriff paid them any mind. No journalist listened to their stories. The bodies of their loved ones disappeared into sacks and reappeared in the cool cellars of medical schools to relinquish their secrets. Every one of them a miracle, in Stevens's view, providing instruction into the intricacies of God's design. Carpenter snarled when he said the word, a mangy dog hoarding his bone, nigger. Stevens never used the word. He disapproved of racial prejudice. Indeed, an uneducated Irishman like Carpenter, steered by society to a life of rummaging graves, had more in common with a Negro than a white doctor. If you considered the matter at length. He wouldn't say that aloud, of course. Sometimes Stevens wondered if his views weren't quaint, given the temper of the modern world. The other students uttered the most horrible things about the colored population of Boston, about their smell, their intellectual deficiencies, their primitive drives. Yet when his classmates put their blades to a colored cadaver, they did more for the cause of colored advancement than the most high-minded abolitionist. In death, the Negro became a human being. Only then was he the white man's equal. On the outskirts of Concord, they stopped at the small wooden gate and waited for the custodian's signal. The man waved his lantern back and forth, and Carpenter drove the cart inside the cemetery. Cobb paid the man's fee, and he directed them to this night's bounty. 2 large, 2 medium, and 3 infants. The rain had softened the earth. They'd be done in 3 hours. After they refilled the graves, it would be as if they were never there. Your surgeon's knife! Carpenter handed Stevens a spade. He'd be a medical student again in the morning. Tonight, he was a resurrection man. Body snatcher was an accurate name. Resurrection man was a bit florid, but it held a truth. He gave these people a second chance to contribute, one denied them in their previous life. And if you could make a study of the dead, Stevens thought from time to time, you could make a study of the living and make them testify as no cadaver could. He rubbed his hands to stir the blood and started to dig. North Carolina. Run away or conveyed off from the subscriber's residence near Henderson on the 16th, a Negro girl named Martha, belonging to the subscriber. Said girl is of a dark brown complexion, slightly made, and very free-spoken, about 21 years of age. She wore a black silk bonnet with feathers and had in her possession 2 calico bed quiltings. I understand she will try to pass as a free girl. Rigdon Banks, Granville County, August 28, 1839. She lost the candles. One of the rats woke Cora with its teeth, and when she settled herself, she crawled across the dirt of the platform in her search. She came up with nothing. It was the day after Sam's house collapsed, though she couldn't be sure. Best to measure time now with one of the Randall plantation's cotton scales, her hunger and fear piling on one side, while her hopes were removed from the other in increments. The only way to know how long you are lost in the darkness is to be saved from it. By then, Cora only needed the candlelight for company, having collected the particulars of her prison. The platform was 28 paces long and 5.5 from wall to track's edge. It was 26 steps up to the world above. The trap door was warm when she placed her palm against it. She knew which step snagged her dress when she crawled up, the 8th, and which liked to scrape her skin if she scrabbled down too fast, the 15th. Cora remembered seeing a broom in a corner of the platform. She used it to tap the ground like the blind lady in town, the way Caesar had probed the black water during their flight. Then she got clumsy or cocky, and fell onto the tracks, losing both the broom and any desire beyond huddling on the ground. She had to get out. In those long hours, she could not keep from devising cruel scenes. arranging her own museum of terrible wonders. Caesar strung up by the grinning mob. Caesar a brutalized mess on the floor of the slave catcher's wagon, halfway back to Randall and the waiting punishments. Kind Sam in jail. Sam, tarred and feathered, interrogated about the Underground Railroad, broken-boned and senseless. A faceless white posse sifted through the smoldering remains of the cabin, pulled up the trapdoor, and delivered her into wretchedness. Those were the scenes she decorated in blood when awake. In nightmares, the exhibits were more grotesque. She strolled back and forth before the glass, a customer of pain. She was locked in life on the slave ship after the museum had closed, ever between ports and waiting for the wind while hundreds of kidnapped souls screamed below decks. Behind the next window, Miss Lucy cut open Cora's stomach with a letter opener, and 1,000 black spiders spilled from her guts. Over and over, she was transported back to the night of the smokehouse, held down by nurses from the hospital as Terrence Randall grunted and thrusted above her. Usually the rats or bugs woke her when their curiosity became too much, interrupting her dreams and returning her to the darkness of the platform. Her stomach quivered under her fingers. She had starved before, when Connolly got it in his mind to punish the quarter for mischief and cut off rations. But they needed food to work, and the cotton demanded the punishment be brief. Here, there was no way to know when she would eat next. The train was late. The night Sam told them about the bad blood, when the house still stood, the next train was due in 2 days. It should have arrived. She didn't know how late it was, but the delay signified nothing good. Maybe this branch was shut down, the entire line exposed and canceled. No one was coming. She was too weak to walk the unknowable miles to the next station in the dark, let alone face whatever waited at the following stop. Caesar. If they had been sensible and kept running, she and Caesar would be in the Free States. Why had they believed that 2 lowly slaves deserved the bounty of South Carolina? That a new life existed so close, just over the state line? It was still the South, and the devil had long, nimble fingers. And then, after all the world had taught them, not to recognize chains when they were snapped to their wrists and ankles. The South Carolina chains were of new manufacture, the keys and tumblers marked by regional design, but accomplished the purpose of chains. They had not traveled very far at all. She could not see her own hand in front of her, but saw Caesar's capture many times. Seized at his factory station, snatched en route to meet Sam at the drift, walking down Main Street arm in arm with his girl, Meg. Meg cries out when they seize him, and they knock her to the sidewalk. That was one thing that would be different if she had made Caesar her lover. They might have been captured together. They would not be alone in their separate prisons. Cora drew her knees to her chest and wrapped her arms around them. In the end, she would have disappointed him. She was a stray, after all. A stray not only in its plantation meaning, orphaned, with no one to look after her, but in every other sphere as well. Somewhere, years ago, she had stepped off the path of life and could no longer find her way back to the family of people. The earth trembled faintly. In days to come, when she remembered the late train's approach, she would not associate the vibration with the locomotive, but with the furious arrival of a truth she had always known. She was a stray in every sense, the last of her tribe. The light of the train shuddered around the bend. Cora reached for her hair, before realizing that after her interment there was no improving her appearance. The engineer would not judge her. Their secret enterprise was a fraternity of odd souls. She waved her hands animatedly, savoring the orange light as it expanded on the platform like a warm bubble. The train sped past the station and out of sight. She almost keeled over into the tracks as she howled after the train, her throat raspy and raw after days of privation. Cora stood and shook, incredulous, until she heard the train stop and back up on the tracks. The engineer was apologetic. "Will you take my sandwich as well?" he asked, as Cora guzzled from his water skin. She ate the sandwich, oblivious to his jest, even though she had never been partial to hog tongue. "You're not supposed to be here," the boy said, adjusting his spectacles. He was no older than 15, raw-boned and eager. "Well, you see me, don't you?" She licked her fingers and tasted dirt. The boy cried, "Gosh!" and "Sweet mother!" at every complication in her story, tucking his thumbs into the pockets of his overalls and rocking on his heels. He spoke like one of the white children Cora had observed in the town square, playing kick the ball with a carefree authority that did not jibe with the color of his skin, let alone the nature of his job. How he came to command the locomotive was a story, but now was not the time for the unlikely histories of colored boys. "Georgia Station is closed," he said finally, scratching his scalp beneath his blue cap. "We're supposed to stay away. Patrollers must have smoked it out, I figure." He clambered into his cabin after his piss pot, then went to the edge of the tunnel and emptied it. "The bosses hadn't heard from the station agent, so I was running express. This stop wasn't on my schedule." He wanted to leave immediately. Cora hesitated, unable to stop herself from looking at the stairs for a last-minute addition. The impossible passenger. Then she started for the cabin. "You can't go up here," the boy said. "It's regulations." "You can't expect me to ride on that," Cora said. "All passengers ride coach on this train, miss. They're pretty strict about that." To call the flat car a coach was an abuse of the word. It was a box car like the one she rode to South Carolina, but only in foundation. The plane of wooden planks was riveted to the undercarriage, without walls or ceiling. She stepped aboard, and the train jolted with the boy's preparations. He turned his head and waved at his passenger with disproportionate enthusiasm. Straps and ropes for oversized freight lay on the floor, loose and serpentine. Cora sat in the center of the flat car, wrapped one around her waist 3 times, grabbed another 2 and fashioned reins. She pulled tight. The train lurched into the tunnel, northward. The engineer yelled, "All aboard!" The boy was simple, Cora decided, responsibilities of his office notwithstanding. She looked back. Her underground prison waned as the darkness reclaimed it. She wondered if she was its final passenger. May the next traveler not tarry and keep moving up the line all the way to liberty. In the journey to South Carolina, Cora had slept in the turbulent car, nestled against Caesar's warm body. She did not sleep on her next train ride. Her so-called coach was sturdier than the boxcar, but the rushing air made the ride into a blustery ordeal. From time to time, Cora had to turn her body to catch her breath. The engineer was more reckless than his predecessor, going faster, goading the machine into velocity. The flat car jumped whenever they took a turn. The closest she had ever been to the sea was her term in the Museum of Natural Wonders. These planks taught her about ships and squalls. The engineer's crooning drifted back. Songs she did not recognize. Debris from the north kicked up by the gale. Eventually, she gave up and lay on her stomach, fingers dug into the seams. "How goes it back there?" the engineer asked when they stopped. They were in the middle of the tunnel, no station in sight. Cora flapped her reins. "Good," the boy said. He wiped the soot and sweat from his forehead. "We're about halfway there. Needed to stretch my legs." He slapped the side of the boiler. "This old girl, she bucks." It wasn't until they were moving again that Cora realized she forgot to ask where they were headed. A careful pattern of colored stones decorated the station beneath Lumley's farm, and wooden slabs covered the walls of Sam's station. The builders of this stop had hacked and blasted it from the unforgiving earth and made no attempt at adornment to showcase the difficulty of their feat. Stripes of white, orange, and rust-colored veins swam through the jags, pits, and knobs. Cora stood in the guts of a mountain. The engineer lit one of the torches on the wall. The laborers hadn't cleaned up when they finished. Crates of gear and mining equipment crowded the platform, making it a workshop. Passengers chose their seating from empty cases of explosive powder. Cora tested the water in one of the barrels. It tasted fresh. Her mouth was an old dustpan after the rain of flying grit in the tunnel. She drank from the dipper for a long time as the engineer watched her, fidgeting. "Where is this place?" she asked. "North Carolina," the boy replied. "This used to be a popular stop, from what I'm told. Not anymore." "The station agent?" Cora asked. "I've never met him, but I'm sure he's a fine fellow." He required fine character and a tolerance for gloom to operate in this pit. After her days beneath Sam's cottage, Cora declined the challenge. "I'm going with you," Cora said. "What's the next station?" "That's what I was trying to say before, miss. I'm in maintenance." Because of his age, he told her, he was entrusted with the engine, but not its human freight. After the Georgia station shut down, he didn't know the details, but gossip held it had been discovered. They were testing all the lines in order to reroute traffic. The train she had been waiting for was canceled, and he didn't know when another one would be through. His instructions were to make a report on conditions and then head back to the junction. "Can't you take me to the next stop?" He motioned her to the edge of the platform and extended his lantern. The tunnel terminated 50 feet ahead in a ragged point. "We passed a branch back there, head south," he said. "I've got just enough coal to check it out and make it back to the depot." "I can't go south," Cora said. "The station agent will be along. I'm sure of it." She missed him when he was gone, in all of his foolishness. Cora had light, and another thing she did not have in South Carolina, sound. Dark water pooled between the rails, fed in steady drips from the station ceiling. The stone vault above was white with splashes of red, like blood from a whipping that soaked a shirt. The noise cheered her, though, as did the plentiful drinking water, the torches, and the distance she had traveled from the slave catchers. North Carolina was an improvement beneath the surface. She explored. The station abutted a rough-hewn tunnel. Support struts shored up the wooden ceiling, and stones embedded in the dirt floor made her stumble. She chose to go left first, stepping over spill that had come loose from the walls. Rusting tools littered the path. Chisels, sledges, and picks, weaponry for battling mountains. The air was damp. When she ran her hand along the wall, it came back coated in cool white dust. At the end of the corridor, the ladder bolted into the stone led up into a snug passage. She lifted the torch. There was no telling how far the rungs extended. She braved the climb only after discovering that the other end of the corridor narrowed into a glum dead end. A few feet into the level above, she saw why the equipment had been abandoned by the work gangs. A sloping mound of rocks and dirt, floor to ceiling, cut off the tunnel. Opposite the cave-in, the tunnel terminated after 100 feet, confirming her fear. She was trapped once more. Cora collapsed on the rocks and wept until sleep overtook her. The station agent woke her.
"Oh,"
the man said. His round red face poked through the space he'd made at the top of the rubble.
"Oh, dear," he said. "What are you doing here?"
"I'm a passenger, sir."
"Don't you know this station is closed?"
She coughed and rose, straightening her filthy dress.
"Oh, dear," he said.
His name was Martin Wells. Together they widened the hole in the wall of stone, and she squeezed through to the other side. The man helped her clamber down to level ground, as if helping a lady from the finest carriage. After several turns, the mouth of the tunnel extended a dim invitation. A breeze tickled her skin. She gulped the air like water. The night sky, the best meal she had ever had. The stars made succulent and ripe after her time below. The station agent was a barrel-shaped man, deep in his middle age, pasty-complected and soft. For an agent of the Underground Railroad, presumably no stranger to peril and risk, he evinced a nervous personality.
"You're not supposed to be here," he said, repeating the engineer's assessment. "This is a very regrettable turn."
Martin huffed through his explanation, washing his sweaty gray hair from his face as he spoke. The night riders were on patrol, he explained, casting agent and passenger into dangerous waters. The old mica mine was remote, to be sure, exhausted long ago by Indians and forgotten by most, but the regulators routinely checked the caves and mines, any place a fugitive might seek refuge from their justice. The cave-in that had so distressed Cora was a ruse to camouflage the operation below. Despite its success, the new laws in North Carolina had rendered the station inoperable. He was visiting the mine merely to leave a message for the Underground Railroad that he could accept no more passengers. When it came to harboring Cora or any other runaway, Martin was unprepared in every way.
"Especially given the present circumstances," he whispered,
as if the patrollers waited at the top of the gully. Martin told her he needed to fetch a wagon, and Cora wasn't convinced he was coming back. He insisted he wouldn't be long. Dawn was approaching, and after that it would be impossible to move her. She was so grateful to be outside in the living world that she decided to believe him, and almost threw her arms around him when he reappeared, driving a weather-beaten wagon pulled by 2 bony draft horses. They repositioned the sacks of grain and seed to make a slim pocket. The last time Cora needed to hide in this manner, they required room for 2. Martin draped a tarpaulin over his cargo, and they rumbled out of the cut, the station agent grumbling profane commentary until they gained the road. They had not traveled long when Martin stopped the horses. He removed the tarpaulin.
"It will be sunrise soon, but I wanted you to see this," the station agent said.
Cora did not immediately know what he meant. The country road was quiet, crowded on both sides by the forest canopy. She saw one shape, then another. Cora got out of the wagon. The corpses hung from trees as rotting ornaments. Some of them were naked, others partially clothed, the trousers black where their bowels emptied when their necks snapped. Gross wounds and injuries marked the flesh of those closest to her, the two caught by the station agent's lantern. One had been castrated, an ugly mouth gaping where his manhood had been. The other was a woman, her belly curved. Cora had never been good at knowing if a body was with a child. Their bulging eyes seemed to rebuke her stares. But what were the attentions of one girl, disturbing their rest, compared to how the world had scourged them since the day they were brought into it?
"They call this road the Freedom Trail now," Martin said as he covered the wagon again. "The bodies go all the way to town."
In what sort of hell had the train let her off? When she next emerged from the wagon, Cora sneaked around the side of Martin's yellow house. The sky was growing light. Martin had brought the wagon as far back into his property as he dared. The homes on either side of his were quite close. Anyone awakened by the horse's noise could see her. Toward the front of the house, Cora saw the street, and beyond that, a grass field. Martin urged her on, and she crept onto the back porch and then inside. A tall white woman in her night clothes leaned against the wainscoting in the kitchen. She sipped a glass of lemonade and did not look at Cora as she said, "You're going to get us murdered." This was Ethel. She and Martin had been married for 35 years. The couple did not speak as he washed his trembling hands in the basin. They had quarreled over her while she waited at the mine, Cora knew, and would resume that argument once they dealt with the matter before them. Ethel led Cora upstairs while Martin returned the wagon to his store. Cora got a brief look at the parlor, which was modestly furnished. After Martin's warnings, the morning light through the window quickened her step. Ethel's long gray hair extended halfway down her back. The woman's manner of walking unnerved Cora. She seemed to float, aloft on her fury. At the top of the stairs, Ethel stopped and pointed to the washroom. "You smell," she said. "Be quick about it." When Cora stepped into the hallway again, the woman summoned her up the stairs to the attic. Cora's head almost brushed the ceiling of the small hot room. Between the sloping walls of the peaked roof, the attic was crammed with years of cast-offs. Two broken washboards, piles of moth-eaten quilts, chairs with split seats, a rocking horse covered in matted hide, sat in the corner under a curl of peeling yellow wallpaper. "We're going to have to cover that now," Ethel said, referring to the window. She moved a crate from the wall, stood on it, and nudged the hatch in the ceiling. "Come, come," she said, her face set in a grimace. She still had not looked at the fugitive. Cora pulled herself up above the false ceiling, into the cramped nook. It came to a point 3 feet from the floor and ran 15 feet in length. She moved the stacks of musty gazettes and books to make more room. Cora heard Ethel descend the stairs, and when her host returned, she handed Cora food, a jug of water, and a chamber pot. Ethel looked at Cora for the first time, her drawn face framed by the hatch. "The girl is coming by and by," she said. "If she hears you, she'll turn us in and they will kill us all. Our daughter and her family arrived this afternoon. They cannot know you are here. Do you understand?"
"How long will it be?"
"You stupid thing, not a sound. Not a single sound. If anyone hears you, we are lost."
She pulled the hatch shut. The only source of light and air was a hole in the wall that faced the street. Cora crawled to it, stooping beneath the rafters. The jagged hole had been carved from the inside, the work of a previous occupant who'd taken issue with the state of the lodgings. She wondered where the person was now. That first day, Cora acquainted herself with the life of the park, the patch of green she'd seen across the street from the house. She pressed her eye to the spy hole, shifting around to capture the entire view. 2- and 3-story wood-frame houses bordered the park on all sides, identical in construction, distinguished by paint color and the type of furniture on their long porches. Neat brick walkways crisscrossed the grass, snaking in and out of the shadows of the tall trees and their luxurious branches. A fountain warbled near the main entrance, surrounded by low stone benches that were occupied soon after sunup and remained popular well into the night. Elderly men with handkerchiefs full of crusts for the birds, children with their kites and balls, and young couples under the spell of romance took their shifts. A brown mutt owned the place, known to all, yipping and scampering. Across the afternoon, children chased it through the grass and onto the sturdy white bandstage at the edge of the park. The mutt dozed in the shade of the benches and the gigantic oak that dominated the green with majestic ease. It was well fed, Cora observed, gobbling down the treats and bones offered by the citizens. Her stomach never failed to rumble at the sight. She named him Mayor. As the sun approached its zenith, and the park bustled with midday traffic, the heat transformed the hidey hole into a wretched furnace. Crawling to different sections of the attic nook, searching for imaginary oases of cool, became her principal activity after her vigil over the park. She learned that her hosts would not visit her during the day, when their girl Fiona was working. Martin tended to his store. Ethel came and went on her social rounds, but Fiona was always downstairs. She was young, with a prominent Irish accent. Cora heard her going about her duties, sighing to herself, and muttering invectives toward her absent employers. Fiona did not enter the attic that first day, but the sound of her steps turned Cora as stiff as her old sailing mate, Skipper John. Ethel's warnings the first morning made their intended impression. On her arrival day, there were additional visitors, Martin and Ethel's daughter, Jane, and her family. From the daughter's bright and pleasant manner, Cora decided she took after her father and filled in her broad face using Martin as a template. The son-in-law and the 2 granddaughters were an unceasing commotion, thundering through the house. At one point, the girl started for the attic, but reconsidered after a discussion about the habits and customs of ghosts. There was indeed a ghost in the house, but she was done with chains, rattling or no. In the evening, the park remained busy. The main street must be nearby, Cora thought, funneling the town. Some older women in blue gingham dresses nailed white and blue bunting to the bandstand. Garlands of orange leaves added a flourish. Families staked out spots before the stage, unrolling blankets and removing supper from baskets. Those who lived next to the park gathered on their porches with jugs and glasses. Preoccupied by her uncomfortable refuge and the parade of misfortunes since the slave catchers found them out, Cora did not immediately notice an important feature of the park. Everyone was white. She had never left the plantation before she and Caesar ran away. So South Carolina gave Cora her first glimpse of the mingling of races in towns and cities. On Main Street, in stores, in factories and offices, in every sector, black and white mixed all day as a matter of course. Human commerce withered without it. In liberty or bondage, the African could not be separated from the American. In North Carolina, the Negro race did not exist, except at the ends of ropes. 2 able young men helped the matrons hang a banner over the bandstand. Friday Festival. A band took its place on stage, the sounds of their warming up gathering the scattered park-goers. Cora hunkered and pressed her face to the wall. The banjo man displayed some talent, the horn player and fiddler less so. Their melodies were bland in comparison to those of the colored musicians she'd heard, on Randall and off. But the townspeople enjoyed the denatured rhythms. The band closed with spirited renditions of two colored songs Cora recognized, which proved the most popular of the night. On the porch below, Martin and Ethel's grandchildren squealed and clapped. A man in a rumpled linen suit took the stage to deliver a brief welcome. Martin told Cora later that this was Judge Tennyson, a respected figure in town when abstemious. This night, he tottered. She couldn't make out the judge's introduction of the next act, a coon show. She'd heard of them but had never witnessed their travesties. The colored evening at the theater in South Carolina offered different fare. Two white men, their faces blackened by burned cork, capered through a series of skits that brought the park to exuberant laughter. Dressed in mismatched, gaudy clothes and chimney pot hats, they molded their voices to exaggerate colored speech. This seemed to be the source of the humor. A sketch where the skinnier performer took off his dilapidated boot and counted his toes over and over again, constantly losing his place, generated the loudest reaction. The final performance, following a notice from the judge regarding the chronic drainage issues at the lake, was a short play. From what Cora put together from the actors' movements and the bits of dialogue that traveled to her suffocating nook, the play concerned a slave, again a white man in burned cork, pink showing on his neck and wrists, who ran north after a light rebuke from his master. He suffered on his journey, delivering a pouty soliloquy on hunger, cold, and wild beasts. In the north, a saloon keeper took him on. The saloon keeper was a ruthless boss, beating and insulting the wayward slave at every turn, stealing wages and dignity, the hard image of northern white attitudes. The last scene depicted the slave on his master's doorstep, having once again run away, this time from the false promises of the free states. He begged after his former position, lamenting his folly and asking for forgiveness. With kind and patient words, the master explained that it was impossible. In the slave's absence, North Carolina had changed. The master whistled, and two patrollers ushered the prostrate slave from the premises. The town appreciated the moral of the performance, their applause resounding through the park. Toddlers clapped from the shoulders of their fathers, and Cora caught Mayor nipping at the air. She had no idea of the size of the town, but felt that every citizen was in the park now, waiting. The true purpose of the evening revealed itself. A sturdy-built man in white trousers and a bright red coat took command of the stage. Despite his size, he moved with force and authority. Cora recalled the mounted bear in the museum, posed at the dramatic moment of his charge. He twisted one end of his handlebar mustache with patient amusement as the crowd quieted. His voice was firm and clear, and for the first time that evening, Cora did not miss a single word. He introduced himself as Jameson, though every soul in the park was aware of his identity.
"Each Friday I awake full of vigor," he said, "knowing that in a few hours we'll gather here again and celebrate our good fortune. Sleep used to come so hard to me in the days before our regulators secured the darkness."
He gestured to the formidable band, 50 strong, who had assembled at the side of the bandstand. The town cheered when the men waved and nodded at Jameson's acknowledgement. Jameson caught the crowd up. God had given one regulator the gift of a newborn son, and two others had observed their birthdays.
We have a new recruit with us tonight, Jameson continued. A young man from a fine family who joined the ranks of the Knight Riders this week. Come on up, Richard, and let them have a look at you.
The slender, red-haired boy advanced tentatively. Like his fellows, he wore his uniform of black trousers and white shirt of thick cloth, his neck swimming in the collar. The boy mumbled. From Jameson's side of the conversation, Cora gathered that the recruit had been making the rounds of the county, learning the protocols of his squad.
And you had an auspicious start, didn't you, son?
The lanky boy bobbed his head. His youth and slight frame reminded Cora of the engineer of her last train trip, inducted by circumstance into the work of men. His freckled skin was lighter hued, but they shared the same fragile eagerness. Born the same day, perhaps, then steered by codes and circumstances to serve disparate agencies.
It's not every rider who makes the catch his first week out, Jameson said. Let's see what young Richard has for us.
Two night riders dragged a colored girl on stage. She had a house girl's tender physique and shrank further in her simpering. Her gray tunic was torn and smeared with blood and filth, and her head had been crudely shaved.
Richard was searching the hold of a steamship bound for Tennessee when he found this rascal hiding below, Jameson said. Louisa is her name. She absconded from her plantation in the confusion of the reorganization and hid in the woods these many months, believing she had escaped the logic of our system.
Louisa rolled over to survey the crowd, lifted her head briefly, and was still. It would have been difficult to make out her tormentors with all the blood in her eyes. Jameson raised his fists in the air, as if daring something in the sky. The night was his opponent, Cora decided, the night and the phantoms he filled it with. In the dark, he said, colored miscreants lurked to violate the citizens' wives and daughters. In the deathless dark, their southern heritage lay defenseless and imperiled. The riders kept them safe.
We have each of us made sacrifices for this new North Carolina and its rights, Jameson said. For this separate nation we have forged, free from northern interference and the contamination of a lesser race. The Black Horde has been beaten back, correcting the mistake made years ago at this nation's nativity. Some, like our brothers just over the state line, have embraced the absurd notion of nigger uplift. Easier to teach a donkey arithmetic.
He bent down to rub Louisa's head.
When we find the odd rascal, our duty is clear.
The crowd separated, tutored by routine. With Jameson leading the procession, the night riders dragged the girl to the great oak in the middle of the park. Cora had seen the wheeled platform in the corner of the park that day. Children climbed and jumped on it all afternoon. At some point in the evening, it had been pushed beneath the oak tree. Jameson called for volunteers, and people of all ages rushed to their places on either side of the platform. The noose lowered around Louisa's neck, and she was led up the stairs. With the precision born of practice, a night rider threw the rope over the thick, sturdy branch with a single toss. One of those who had gathered to push the ramp away was ejected. He'd already taken his turn at a previous festival. A young brunette in a pink polka dot dress rushed to take his place. Cora turned away before the girl swung. She crawled to the opposite side of the nook in the corner of her latest cage. Over the next several months, on nights when it was not too suffocating, she preferred that corner for sleeping. It was as far from the park, the miserable thumping heart of the town, as she could get. The town hushed. Jameson gave the word. To explain why he and his wife kept Cora imprisoned in their attic, Martin had to go back a ways. As with everything in the South, it started with cotton. The ruthless engine of cotton required its fuel of African bodies. Crisscrossing the ocean, ships brought bodies to work the land and to breed more bodies. The pistons of this engine moved without relent. More slaves led to more cotton, which led to more money to buy more land to farm more cotton. Even with the termination of the slave trade in less than a generation, the numbers were untenable. All those niggers. Whites outnumbered slaves 2-1 in North Carolina. But in Louisiana and Georgia, the populations neared parity. Just over the border in South Carolina, the number of blacks surpassed that of whites by more than 100,000. It was not difficult to imagine the sequence when the slave cast off his chains in pursuit of freedom and retribution. In Georgia and Kentucky, South America and the Caribbean Isles, the Africans turned on their masters in short but disturbing encounters. Before the Southampton Rebellion was smothered, Turner and his band murdered 65 men, women, and children. Civilian militias and patrollers lynched 3 times that in response. Conspirators, sympathizers, and innocents, to set an example, to clarify the terms. But the numbers remained, declaring a truth unclouded by prejudice.
Around here, the closest thing to a constable was the patroller, Martin said.
Most places, Cora said, patroller will harass you anytime they feel like.
It was after midnight, her first Monday. Martin's daughter and her family had returned home, as had Fiona, who lived down the road in Irish Town. Martin perched on a crate in the attic, fanning himself. Cora paced and stretched her sore limbs. She had not stood in days. Ethel declined to appear. Dark blue drapes hid the windows and the small candle licked at the gloom. Despite the hour, Martin spoke in a whisper. His next-door neighbor's son was a night rider. As the slave owner's enforcers, the patrollers were the law, white, crooked, and merciless. Drawn from the lowest and most vicious segment, too witless to even become overseers, Cora nodded in agreement, the patroller required no reason to stop a person apart from color. Slaves caught off the plantation needed passes, unless they wanted a licking and a visit to the county jail. Free blacks carried proof of manumission or risked being conveyed into the clutches of slavery. Sometimes they were smuggled to the auction block anyway. Rogue blacks who did not surrender could be shot. They searched slave villages at will and took liberties as they ransacked the homes of free men, stealing hard-earned linens or making licentious advances. In war, and to put down a slave rebellion was the most glorious call to arms, the patrollers transcended their origins to become a true army. Cora pictured the insurrections as great bloody battles, unfurling beneath a night sky lit by vast fires. From Martin's accounts, the actual uprisings were small and chaotic. The slaves walked the roads between towns with their scavenged weapons, hatchets and scythes, knives and bricks. Tipped by colored turncoats, the white enforcers organized elaborate ambushes, decimating the insurgents with gunfire and running them down on horseback, reinforced by the might of the United States Army. At the first alarms, civilian volunteers joined the patrollers to quell the disturbance, invading the quarters and putting free men's homes to the torch. Suspects and bystanders crammed the jails. They strung up the guilty and, in the interest of prevention, a robust percentage of the innocent. Once the slain had been avenged, and more important, the insult to white order repaid with interest, the civilians returned to their farms and factories and stores,
and the patrollers resumed their rounds. The revolts were quashed, but the immensity of the colored population remained. The verdict of the census lay in glum columns and rows. "We know it, but don't say it," Cora told Martin. The crate creaked as Martin shifted. "And if we say, we don't say it for anyone to hear," Cora said. "How big we are." On a chilly evening last autumn, the powerful men of North Carolina convened to solve the colored question. Politicians attuned to the shifting complexities of the slavery debate, wealthy farmers who drove the beast of cotton and felt the reins slipping, and the requisite lawyers to fire the soft clay of their schemes into permanence. Jameson was present, Martin told Cora, in his capacities as a senator and local planter. It was a long night. They assembled in Oney Garrison's dining room. Oney lived atop Justice Hill, so named because it allowed one to see everything below for miles and miles, placing the world in proportion. After this night, their meeting would be known as the Justice Convention. Their host's father had been a member of the Cotton Vanguard and a savvy proselytizer of the miracle crop. Oney grew up surrounded by the prophets of cotton and its necessary evil, niggers. The more he thought about it as he sat there in his dining room, taking in the long, pallid faces of the men who drank his liquor and overstayed their welcome, what he really wanted was simply more of the former and less of the latter. Why were they spending so much time worrying about slave uprisings and Northern influence in Congress when the real issue was who was going to pick all this goddamned cotton? In the coming days, the newspapers printed the numbers for all to see, Martin said. There were almost 300,000 slaves in North Carolina. Every year, that same number of Europeans, Irish and Germans mostly, fleeing famine and political unpleasantness, streamed into the harbors of Boston, New York, Philadelphia. On the floor of the State House, in the editorial pages, the question was put forth. Why cede this supply to the Yankees? Why not alter the course of that human tributary so that it fed southward? Advertisements in overseas papers promoted the benefits of term labor. Advance agents expounded in taverns and town meetings and poorhouses, and in due course, the charter ships teemed with their willing human cargo, bringing dreamers to the shores of a new country. Then they disembarked to work the fields.
"Never seen a white person pick cotton," Cora said. "Before I came back to North Carolina, I'd never seen a mob rip a man limb from limb," Martin said. "See that? You stop saying what folks will do and what they won't."
True. You couldn't treat an Irishman like an African, white nigger or no. There was the cost of buying slaves and their upkeep on one hand, and paying white workers meager but livable wages on the other. The reality of slave violence versus stability in the long term. The Europeans had been farmers before, they would be farmers again. Once the immigrants finished their contracts, having paid back travel, tools, and lodging, and took their place in American society, they would be allies of the Southern system that had nurtured them. On election day, when they took their turn at the ballot box, theirs would be a full vote, not three-fifths. A financial reckoning was inevitable, but come the approaching conflict over the race question, North Carolina would emerge in the most advantageous position of all the slave states. In effect, they abolished slavery. "On the contrary," Oney Garrison said in response, "we abolished niggers."
"All the women and children, the men, where did they go?" Cora asked.
Someone shouted in the park, and the two in the attic were still for a while.
"You saw," Martin said.
The North Carolina government, half of which crowded into Garrison's dining room that night, purchased existing slaves from farmers at favorable rates, just as Great Britain had done when it abolished slavery decades ago. The other states of the Cotton Empire absorbed the stock. Florida and Louisiana, in their explosive growth, were particularly famished for colored hands, especially the seasoned variety. A short tour of Bourbon Street forecast the result to any observer, a repulsive, mongrel state in which the white race is, through amalgamation with Negro blood, made stained, obscured, confused. Let them pollute their European bloodlines with Egyptian darkness, produce a river of half-breeds, quadroons, and miscellaneous dingy yellow bastards. They forge the very blades that will be used to cut their throats. The new race laws forbid colored men and women from setting foot on North Carolina soil. Free men who refused to leave their land were run off or massacred. Veterans of the Indian campaigns earned generous mercenary coin for their expertise. Once the soldiers finished their work, the former patrollers took on the mantle of night riders, rounding up strays, slaves who tried to outrun the new order, dispossessed freemen without the means to make it north, luckless colored men and women lost in the land for any number of reasons. When Cora woke up that first Saturday morning, she put off looking through the spy hole. When she finally steeled herself, they had already cut down Louisa's body. Children skipped underneath the spot where she had dangled. "The road," Cora said. "The Freedom Trail, you called it. How far does it go?" "It extended as far as there were bodies to feed it," Martin said. "Putrefying bodies. Bodies consumed by carrion eaters were constantly replaced, but the heading always advanced. Every town of any real size held their Friday festival, closing with the same grim finale. Some places reserved extra captives in the jail for a fallow week when the night riders returned empty-handed. Whites punished under the new legislation were merely hung, not put on display. Although, Martin qualified, there was the case of a white farmer who had sheltered a gang of colored refugees. When they combed through the ashes of the house, it was impossible to pick his body from those he had harbored, as the fire had eliminated the differences in their skin, leveling them. All five bodies were hung on the trail, and nobody made much of a fuss over the breach in protocol. With the topic of white persecution, they had arrived at the reason for her term in the nook.
"You understand our predicament," Martin said.
"Abolitionists had always been run off here," he said. "Virginia or Delaware might tolerate their agitating, but no cotton state. Owning the literature was enough for a spell in jail, and when you were released, you did not stay in town long. In the amendments to the state's constitution, the punishment for possessing seditious writings or for aiding and abetting a colored person was left to the discretion of local authorities. In practice, the verdict was death. The accused were dragged from their homes by their hair. Slave owners who refused to comply, from sentiment or a quaint notion about property rights, were strung up, as well as kind-hearted citizens who hid niggers in their attics and cellars and coal bins. After a lull in white arrests, some towns increased the rewards for turning in collaborators. Folks informed on business rivals, ancient nemesis, and neighbors recounting old conversations where the traitors had uttered forbidden sympathies. Children tattled on their parents, taught by schoolmistresses the hallmarks of sedition. Martin related the story of a man in town who had been trying to rid himself of his wife for years to no avail. The details of her crime did not hold up under scrutiny, but she paid the ultimate price. The gentleman remarried 3 months later.
"Is he happy?" Cora asked.
"What?"
Cora waved her hand.
The severity of Martin's account had sent her down an avenue of odd humor. Before, slave patrollers searched the premises of colored individuals at will, be they free or enslaved. Their expanded powers permitted them to knock on anyone's door to pursue an accusation and for random inspections as well, in the name of public safety. The regulators called at all hours, visiting the poorest trapper and wealthiest magistrate alike. Wagons and carriages were stopped at checkpoints. The mica mine was only a few miles away. Even if Martin had the grit to run with Cora, they would not make it to the next county without an examination. Cora thought that the whites would be loath to give up their freedoms, even in the name of security. Far from instilling resentment, Martin told her, the patrollers' diligence was a point of pride from county to county. Patriots boasted of how often they'd been searched and given a clean bill. A night rider's call on the home of a comely young woman had led to more than one happy engagement. They twice searched Martin and Ethel's house before Cora appeared. The riders were perfectly pleasant, complimenting Ethel on her ginger cake. They did not look askance at the attic hatch, but that was no guarantee that next time things would proceed along the same lines. The second visit caused Martin to resign from his duties with the railroad. There were no plans for the next leg of Cora's journey. No word from associates. They would have to wait for a sign. Once again, Martin apologized for his wife's behavior.
You understand, she's scared to death. We're at the mercy of fate.
You feel like a slave? Cora asked. Ethel hadn't chosen this life, Martin said.
You were born to it, like a slave.
That put an end to their conversation that night. Cora climbed up into the nook with fresh rations and a clean chamber pot. Her routine established itself quickly. It could not have been otherwise, given the constraints. After she knocked her head into the roof a dozen times, her body remembered the limits on her movement. Cora slept, nestled between the rafters as if in the cramped hold of a ship. She watched the park. She worked on her reading, making the best of the education that had been cut short in South Carolina, squinting in the spy hole's dim light. She wondered why there were only two kinds of weather, hardship in the morning and tribulation at night. Every Friday, the town held its festival, and Cora retreated to the opposite side of the nook. The heat was impossible most days. On the worst, she gulped at the hole like a fish in a bucket. Sometimes she neglected to ration her water, imbibing too much in the morning and staring with bitterness at the fountain the rest of the day. That damn dog cavorting in the spray. When the heat made her faint, she awoke with her head smeared into a rafter, her neck feeling like a chicken's after Alice the cook tried to wring it for supper. The meat she put on her bones in South Carolina melted away. Her host replaced her soiled dress with one his daughter had left behind. Jane was scarce-hipped, and Cora now fit into her clothes with room. Near midnight, after all the lights in the houses facing the park were extinguished, and Fiona had long gone home, Martin brought food. Cora descended into the attic proper to stretch and breathe different air. They talked some. Then, at a certain point, Martin would stand with a solemn expression, and Cora clambered back into the nook. Every few days, Ethel permitted Martin to give her a brief visit to the washroom. Cora always fell asleep following Martin's visit, sometimes after an interval of sobbing, and sometimes so quickly she was like a candle being blown out. She returned to her violent dreams. She tracked the regulars on their daily transits through the park, assembling notes and speculations like the compilers of her almanacs. Martin kept abolitionist newspapers and pamphlets in the nook. They were a danger. Ethel wanted them gone. But they had been his father's and predated their residence in the house, so Martin figured they could deny ownership. Once Cora had gleaned what she could from the yellowed pamphlets, she started on the old almanacs, with their projections and ruminations about the tides and stars, and bits of obscure commentary. Martin brought her a Bible. On one of her short interludes down in the attic, she saw a copy of The Last of the Mohicans that had been warped and swollen by water. She huddled by the spy hole for reading light, and in the evening curled around a candle. Cora opened Martin's visits with the same question. Any word? After a few months, she stopped. The silence from the railroad was complete. The gazettes printed reports of raided depots and station agents brought to raw justice, but those were common slave state fables. Previously, strangers knocked on Martin's door with messages concerning routes, and once, news of a confirmed passenger. Never the same person twice. No one had come in a long time, Martin said. By his lights, there was nothing for him to do.
You won't let me leave, Cora said. His reply was a whimper.
The situation is plain. It was a perfect trap, he said, for everyone. You won't make it. They'll catch you. Then you'll tell them who